Artists over the centuries have had a grand time with heaven. Usually there are lots of white fluffy clouds, cherubic figures in Greco-Roman garb, and a male god, chubby and aged, lounging about. As a 14-year-old once remarked, who'd want to live there? Our liberal Anglican tradition has shied away from being too specific about the afterlife. Rather, we have said that just as in life we are in God, so in death. Heaven is where God is, and God is everywhere. In other words, the tradition is somewhat agnostic about life after death, acknowledging that there is no certainty. Yet it also affirms that God breaks the boundaries of normal and may break this one too. The Bible is fuzzy on the specifics of heaven. Rather, the writers paint verbal pictures of what it might be like. Revelations 21, for example, describes a heavenly city, Jerusalem the golden, walled with wonderful gates of precious stones, the streets made of gold. This is where Elton gets his yellow brick road from. And these gates are always open. All are welcome to come and go. For the poor and impoverished, this vision of the afterlife was very appealing. There was welcome and wealth. They might have imagined that this was God's justice, making up for their earthly hardships. Another picture is John 14, verse 2. In my Father's house, there are many dwelling places. Heaven is envisioned as a huge hotel. There's room for everyone, and everyone has a room, even with an ensuite. It allows for diversity. We don't all have to fit, be squeezed into the same room. Physically, spiritually, sexually, we can be different. We can be ourselves. For those who are homeless, who have never had a room of their own, who've been pushed about by government policies and sardined into the schemes of others, such a vision of space and respect has great appeal. Again, people might have thought that God was making up for their earthly sufferings and giving them happiness they hadn't previously known. A third biblical picture of heaven is of a party. Isaiah 25. On this mountain, God will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, and God will swallow up death and wipe away the tears. This is a celebration. Here the wealth is evident in the food and its abundance. Here all peoples are welcome, akin to the hotel picture. Here, unlike the former two pictures, there are people connecting with other people. Food for the stomach and the soul are shared. There are other pictures of heaven in the Bible. Throne room, singing, white robes, judgment, and of course those little angels. The point is that the Bible doesn't have one view of heaven, as if someone had been to a literal place and taken snapshots. Instead, the Bible includes different and various pictures in order to implicitly criticize the validity of any one picture. It is saying that the dwelling of God is bigger than our ideas of it, the canvas bigger than the picture we can possibly paint. The vision of heaven as hope for the impoverished, homeless, and hungry has had an appeal down through the ages. Yet the vision was always broader than physical needs. As in Revelations, John, and Isaiah, it included welcome, individual space and respect, and connection with others. Happiness required more than food, money, and housing. The academic discipline called the School of Positive Psychology agree with this. They have done numerous studies searching for the ingredients of happiness and have come up with three staples. The first is that which caters for our body, appetite, and feelings of well-being. This is family, friends, relationships, money, cars, holidays, parties, sport, wine, good food, and coffee. It is the sensation of hearing beautiful music or skiing down a mountain. It's also the sensation of being loved and valued. Many people make the mistake of thinking that this is all there is to happiness. With wealth, health, relationships, and opportunities, anyone and everyone will be happy, they say. Well, they are certainly ingredients, but they're not the whole cake. The second staple of happiness is altruism. By that I mean being a part of something and contributing to something beyond our individual or family needs. It's about doing something for the good of others and being part of something bigger than ourselves. In those slightly antiquated words like service and charity, there's an important ingredient in our quest to find meaning and happiness. When we give, when we do something for others, when we nurture that wellspring of generosity within us, we nurture too our own soul. The third staple of happiness is purpose. The person who has a goal and the drive to fulfill it experiences a particular type of happiness. The purpose might be to create a supportive family, or build a house, or achieve in sport, or develop a project, or discover a cure. It's achievement focused. Of course, when a person has multiple goals, as many of us do, then frequently the time demands of the goals conflict, like being successful at work and successful at parenting. There's also the necessity and art of continually setting new goals and finding new purpose, such as around the time of retirement from paid work. When purpose becomes purely the creation of wealth, and wealth is purely for personal enjoyment, then the potential for happiness is reduced. Happiness requires us to have or find meaning that is more than the satisfaction of our appetites. The proponents of positive psychology say that we need all three ingredients in order to be happy. We need the good feelings, we need to give to others, and to find purpose. And this is why religions which seek to do all three are important in society. It's also why discipline and self-restraint are important. Popular TV shows usually promote self-gratification. It's all about body, booty, and babes. Yet happiness requires the discipline of giving your resources to a cause bigger than us, and the discipline of focusing on purpose. To feed the world, we need to constrain our appetites. Alexander Solzhenitsyn once wrote, in reference to Western society, "One almost never sees voluntary restraint. Left without electrical power for a few hours, for example, all of a sudden, crowds of citizens start looting and creating havoc. This indicates a social system quite unstable and unhealthy." In the political life of our nation, it is timely to contemplate upon these things. What can the government give me is not the only question. Nor is the question, what can I give to others? There are also questions about our communal purpose as a nation. What might we offer the world? And what might we have to do differently, even give up, in order to achieve it? I listen intently for any politician or party who might be saying these important things about vision, meaning, and ultimately our happiness. The biblical visions of heavenly happiness, of having home, income, and food, of having respect, space, and connection with each other, continue to inform our vision of earthly happiness. Yet these need to be placed alongside the life of Jesus. For in him we see a life filled with friendship and fellowship, with generosity and self-giving, and with purpose and its discipline. To the 14-year-old who disdains the idea of a white, fluffy, heavenly afterlife, I offer the meaning, variety, and well-being of a Jesus life for the now and for the hereafter.